How is it, Sterling Newberry, that politics is now spoken of in language out of the computer business, open source campaigns, the whole notion that networked customers get smarter faster than most companies, that it's that the model of this campaign in a degree is the Linux users against Microsoft?
Let me take an example. When Microsoft sends their new version of Office, they dump a bucket of bits on a CD and they hand it to you. And they say, you can push these bits around, you can sort of slosh them around with the configuration, but you can't look at how they function. You don't have control over the source code. Look at politics. The source code of politics, law, policy papers, economic statistics, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, were not under people's hands. They had to accept whatever bucket of bits the government dumped on them or stockbrokers dumped on them. And that was it. You could sort of push them around. You could make a few choices. You could rebalance your portfolio. But you didn't have access to the source code of politics or the source code of computers. Open source politics is an analogy. Just as Linux is sent to the individual, not just as a bucket of bits, but the individual source code. What is happening on the internet is it's allowing people to get back inside the source code of politics. The same thing is happening in our media. We no longer have content delivered through the television and dumped on our laps. People take it, they put it on TiVo, they edit out the commercials, they splice things together, they watch an entire season of a show at once. People can even change the soundtracks, remove the dubbing, make changes. Our media world is now in our hands. We have the ability to put our hands on computer code, our hands on law and politics, our hands on the media. We're no longer consumers. We are producers as well. And that is the change of open source, because it's allowing people to take control of things which were opaque, which were black boxes to them for about 30 to 40 years in the late 20th century. Western civilization grew up on open source. The first open source revolution in Western history is the printing press, and suddenly everybody could read the Bible and decide for himself or herself what the important words and phrases were and reassemble the contents. And that's the Protestant revolution. That's an open source revolution which allowed people to learn dances, which allowed people to see the mathematics, which allowed people to get their hands on the very substance of the spiritual and the substance of the political as it existed in 1500. And you see the same kinds of disbalancing political tensions in the 1500s that you see today.
Sterling Newberry, do you have a big frame around this campaign year? I mean, do you have a sense of how it comes out? I mean, is George Bush beatable? Do the Democrats know how to take power?
George Bush has already lost the election. Whether the Democrats can pick up the election which the Republican leadership has dropped on the ground is another question. Many campaigns, battles, and contests have been lost by one side only to be lost again right back by the other side. The question for the Democrats is whether they can realize that they cannot win a tight swing election where you convince the least informed 5% of the electorate to shift their ballots in the last month. They can't win that election. They can win the election where they go to the 15% of the electorate that is deeply troubled about the direction of American policy and go to them and say, we have an idea, a program, and a series of policy understandings that will lead America back to being in control of its own destiny. There are 60 or 70 what are called pizza crust districts across the country which are heavily suburban, which are densely populated with people who have been very badly damaged by the jobs drought, by the budget deficits, by the tax shifts from the federal government to local property taxes. There have been no tax cuts. We are still taxing people the same percentage of their income as we did in 2000. We're just simply sending the bill from a different address. These districts will shift the election. If they are convinced that George Bush cannot lead, cannot bring things under control, that all he can do is give a quick hit of fiscal stimulus, a quick hit of monetary stimulus, which is unsustainable, they will desert the Republican leadership and they will reopen the ability to create strong coalitions in politics, and the Democrats will not only win the presidency, they will win Congress, and they will win the debate.
The master narrative that we read in the paper is still basically 1960. A bunch of bright people around a charismatic candidate try to figure out how to parlay New Hampshire, now Iowa, bounce it into media acceptance and in a popular steamroller. Underneath, it seems to me the narrative has changed entirely about the way the country actually deliberates about the next president. Can you summarize a new master narrative that encompasses open source politics, blogs, new media, memes, which is to say idea viruses, all the new grassroots dominance of the process?
The new master narrative runs this way. A particular individual speaks very powerfully and directly, not to the vast mass of people, but to specific individuals who are receptive to their particular message, that have a particular connection to this candidate. These people will begin to organize a coherent and complex message and community to support, promote, and disseminate that candidate's message. The candidates who attempt to bypass this process will find that they have no deep support among the populace. Those people are going to be the ones who move the early donations and who create the early wave. The press will pick up on this authenticity, just as Dean and Clark this year were the bearers of this process. In 2008, every presidential candidate, whichever party has the incumbent party, whichever party is the challenging party, is going to go through the same process. The next phase, the phase that we are in now, will be the moment where you convert the evangelists into a strong movement of powerful popular support. And that will determine how the early primaries go. Dean was at 1% this time last year in national polls. Clark was an asterisk. Those two candidates in the national polls, on average, poll somewhere around 38% to 40% of the Democratic primary vote, even more if you look at likely Democratic primary voters. The traditional campaigns are nowhere. They've gone in reverse. I said in May, Dean's the front runner. He's the only one running forward right now among the declared candidates. The primary blitz is going to be more and more compressed. It's going to be more and more a test of the organization that you built up. If your organization is ready on January 1, you will have a chance in that primary blitz. If your organization is not ready, if your movement is not ready on January 1, you will be blown out of the water. Gephardt is struggling as hard as he can just to barely hold on to first place in a state that he has been campaigning in for almost 20 years. Dean is number two in that state, and he didn't even visit Iowa until the new millennium had passed. This is the change. The next phase, however, is going to be this long period between the nominee is determined somewhere in March and the conventions. In 2000, it was a dead space. The candidates basically hunkered down and tried to spend as little money as possible. The new politics is going to be, this is the period where the candidate turns his primary message into the general election message. This is the period of time when the community of people focused on winning a particular primary and a particular nomination are going to turn first to the whole party and say, we now need to unify the party and create a unified party message, and then turn the corner again and reach out into the entire country and say, this is the general message. This is the message that everybody can subscribe to. This is the consensus for action which this candidate stands for and is the bearer of. And that is a very powerful change in politics, because that's a politics of not saying less, it's a politics of saying more. It's not a politics of mean as little as possible so that you can mean everything to everybody and end up meaning nothing to anybody. It's a politics of having a conversation and a dialogue where people can find themselves. I don't have to agree with the candidate anymore. I just have to feel that if I join this candidate's conversation, that my key, crucial interests will be respected, that I will have a share in the decisions that mean something to me, that I will be listened to, and that I can organize a sphere of people around me who can push the issues in the right direction in this politics.
Sterling Newberry, sum up this transformation you're talking about. First, in terms that you keep coming back to, the pyramid and the sphere.
The pyramid is top-down. The pyramid is a relic of analog technology and if bureaucracy is the way that you have to organize people.
The pyramid is Walter Cronkite saying, that's the way it is, or the New York Times delivering
Absolutely.
God's reading on your doorstep.
Absolutely. The pyramid is also bureaucracy, large corporations, mass production, packaged consumer goods, which you have a choice of five different perfumes
mass
to put in your laundry. The sphere is the ability of individuals to connect. It is digital. It is into the center and then back out again. Instead of having a top that is in charge and in control, you have a center, which is the standard, which keeps the message coherent, or the software coherent, or the politics coherent, but it does not control the individual. The individual is still fully formed as an individual.
Sounds to me like Ralph Waldo Emerson's images of circles, starting with the eyeball, extending to the horizon. He says we are capable of innumerable expansions, always in the spherical circular mode.
You know that I love that essay, and one of the best points early in that essay is when he says, St. Augustine says that God is a circle whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. Mm. And that's the image that you should have of what's happening on the internet. Anyone at any given day can be the center if he has the best observation that resonates. There is no boundary to the circle. Something could go all the way around the world and come back to you, and it has changed in a positive way. You get to sing a song and listen to the echo that has come back to you around the world and know how people have perceived what you've done, how your audience has perceived what you've done, how other people have used what you've done, how other people have taken what you've done and turned it into their center. That's a very powerful metaphor for what's going on, as opposed to the top, which pushes downwards, and at the bottom, an individual is reduced to yes, no, Republican, Democrat, Tide, Cheer, Coke, Pepsi. Instead, the individual has a complex and rich series of choices, and they can change the choices that they have. One of the expressions we had in the Clark campaign is, we didn't have a choice, so we made a choice. The people who joined the Clark and the Dean movements made those candidates in a much more profound way than people have been able to make a candidate in decades in the American political experience.
Can you explain this transformation, we're calling it, in terms of analog world to digital world?
Well, that's a good analogy. In the old bureaucratic top-down model of society, you had a shortage of people who could crunch the numbers, give the orders, keep control of things. There was a shortage of people who were good enough to be movie stars, who were good enough to be politicians, who were good enough to be masters of whatever they were. And so the entire society was designed to disseminate those few masters out into everything. And the pyramid is built to disseminate a few decisions all the way outwards. Each copy of a message in that world degrades.
Each carbon is lighter.
And harder to read and has more noise in it. The signal gets fainter and fainter. In the digital world, each copy can be better than the copy before. In a digital world, you can get control of the very source of the music itself without an expensive studio. In a digital world, you can take the television program and splice out the commercials and put together an entire season of a program and watch it yourself. In the digital world, everybody is a producer as well as a consumer. Now, everything that we produce in the world of information is source code, and everything can be disseminated, and everyone can be the originator of new ideas and new knowledge.
Can you explain this transformation in kind of cultural terms, zeitgeist terms, even musical terms?
One of the things that I've seen in the Clark movement is there's a lot of young people, but there's also a lot of people who are in their 50s and 60s who feel the same kind of energy that they felt when they were young, the same kind of impulse. In the 1960s, there was a change happening in society, and that's what led to demonstrations, the civil rights movement, the changes in society. But there were particular places which were the cutting edge, the place where you could see it, you could feel it, you couldn't escape it. Rock music was in your face. It was a demonstration of the change. You turned on the radio, and there it was. You got it or you didn't. You
couldn't escape it. The times, they are a-changing.
Absolutely. Now the internet is the cutting edge of a change in society, and the blog space is where it's right in your face. You get it or you don't. You see it or you don't. You feel it or you don't. And you know almost instantaneously the people who have it and the people who don't. Just as when jazz came in, there were people who could swing and there were people who couldn't. It didn't mean anything if you didn't have that feeling. This is the same kind of wave. There's a rhythm, there's an energy, there's a pulse. There's a series of connections, and once you're into it, you can simply spin out an entire piece, an entire idea, and your fingers just move, and the idea comes out, and you say when you finished writing it, my hands are smarter than I am.
We like the change, I take it.
We need the change. We can't go back.
Who are the bloggers on this playing field of the internet?
Well, nobody likes the word blog, and I think there's a problem with the word bloggers, because it implies that people running blogs are shut-ins who are stuck in front of their keyboard just typing whatever comes into their head. A million monkeys in search of an editor is what one person worried that they would become. Blogging has taken off because people who do real work are using their internet websites as a way of presenting their work as it is happening so that people can feel the developing, blooming, growing and powerful nature of what is being done in the society. The blogs that work, the ones that get it, are not generally run by people who spend all of their time blogging. They're run by people who spend all of their time doing interesting, exciting, and powerful things, and they want to find a forum where they can present these ideas, these activities, to an audience that responds and can get feedback from them. So, Marcos Mulitas Zuniga is not a blogger, he's a political consultant who blogs. Sterling Newberry isn't a blogger, he's a political thinker, he is an individual with computer skills and with a broad view of the world who compresses his understanding of the political process into a series of blogs. The people who are making things happen, like Bill Mon, like Brad DeLong, are people who are Main Street America professionals, and they want a forum where they can be three-dimensional, their full selves, before an audience which is tightly interacting with them, in the same way that Mozart had a small fan base of about 500 people who really got his orchestral music, and he wrote for them, and they talked to him. We've gone back to that very intimate kind of powerfully connected audience, and that's what is making the blogs take off. They're no longer people screaming at the top of their lungs because they're so frustrated. You can't live at the top of their lungs. The tone has changed. The content has changed. The meaning has changed. They're the cutting edge of what people are actually doing in the real world. And that's the heart of authenticity. What really works.
Do you have a theory, Sterling Newberry, about why the blog moment, the war, the onset of the 2004 campaign, the doldrums in the economy, the evolution of the computer industry all seem to come together sometime in 2003?
Because people no longer trusted the establishment media to tell them the truth, to give them the information they needed to have, and to focus on the stories that were really important to them. We were not told the information we needed to have about Iraq, and Iraq was basically treated as a giant O.J. Simpson trial, where people were posturing and trying to hide the truth from the public in order to get the outcome that they desired from a particular jury of public opinion. The reason this has exploded this year is people look at the results and they say, we have been lied to. People want an authenticity of news. People want a restoration of a time where they actually knew what was going on and could therefore make informed political decisions. That's the heart of Jeffersonian democracy. There can never be a people who are free and ignorant, and never will be, he said. And the blog space is the cutting edge of reporters, of politicians, of the general public, of specialists, of the entire interested and informed electorate finding a way to rebuild a community that has been shattered by a media which is increasingly smoke and mirrors and spokesmen fleshing at you.
I like that whole idea. I'd only throw in Jason Blair as a kind of accident who crystallized this disbelief. Disbelief in the old media. The poor black faker on the New York Times who was just piping nonsense into the paper. But he crystallized this notion that we need other ways to get authentic information now.
There have been several incidents where authors have been found out. There was the Glass affair at the New Republic. There were plagiarism scandals among established historians. It touches upon the problem of how does somebody get into the media pipeline? The old media pipeline has gatekeepers. There are people who are writers, and there are people who are not. The blog space has a different filtering mechanism. If you can't write, nobody will read what you write. If you don't have the ability to crystallize people's emotions. The old media also lives by the anecdote. In television, you need a picture. It's government by anecdote. It's society by anecdote. The internet lives and dies by the facts. Can you establish a case? Can you establish not one anecdote, but a dozen?
This is so interesting, because the old media traditionally has said, how can you have an internet information system without gatekeepers? Have we solved that problem? Do we know who the gatekeepers are? Do we know what the kind of human intuitive monitors are that say, wait a sec, Atreus makes sense?
As the social history of credibility makes clear, we're never going to solve this problem, because human beings are biased creatures. We shade the truth depending on who we're talking to. We shade the truth depending on how we want to remember it. There will never be a solving of this problem. What the internet is making clear is that the process of filtering by a community can produce coherency, because people want things to work. As soon as people have to make things work, they have a very, very clear line between this is real and this is nonsense. I need to find the information to make a decision. And suddenly they have a very low tolerance for entertainment passing itself off as political commentary, for the Rush Limbaughs of this world and his versions on the internet.
Sum it up in terms of the blogs, Sterling Newbray. Are they the effect? Are they the cause? Are they the vehicle? Are they the metaphor? What's driving what here?
The blogs are the process of communalizing facts and information. They are where the community comes to a common understanding of what has happened and crystallizes that into a series of words, phrases, and ideas which can drive the conversation on a day-to-day basis. It's where we decide how we're going to react by seeing how our fellow citizens who are also active and articulate and coherent have reacted. In a sense, September 11th left a huge resonant impact on the American psyche, but if you think about it, the internet bubble, the crash of the stock market, September 11th, Iraq are one hammer on the psyche after another, and we could not find in the mass media a conversation, a way of generating a sense of bonding to our fellow citizens. And if you ask people like Dr. Jonathan Shea, the most important thing for coming to terms with a traumatic event is having a community of people with whom you feel a deep connection and who understand what you mean when you say a particular word or particular phrase, the richness of contextualized information. That's what the blog space does. That's a very important function, and it's the function which allows the whole process to move forward and allows it to generate pressure going outwards into society, because suddenly you have a group of people who are not alienated and isolated and angry going out and screaming at their fellow Americans, why can you put up with this man in the White House, which, if you believe that George Bush is a bad president, will convince somebody, but it won't convince the person who is unsure. The key to what the blogs do is it turns the person who is angry, upset, and alienated into somebody who is furious but coherent and knows where to put the wedge so that he cuts down the base of the tree. It's the Thoreau analogy. There's one person chopping at the root for every thousand who are beating at the bushes. The blogs make it so that you're chopping at the root of the problem, because you suddenly have a community of people who are allowing you to both simultaneously vent your frustration and focus your anger.
Is there a timeline on this transformation?
There is a timeline. Somewhere in the late 1990s, the sense of urgency came back to American society in the economy. Somewhere in 2001, the sense of urgency came back to American politics. The internet provided tools. The micromedia of cable news and of intelligent talk radio provided tools and outlets, but there was no way to bind them together. There was no social glue to connect them. The reason the blogs are so important is not because they're driving the process. the thinking, the doing, the acting, the politicking, the writing is driving the process. But the blogs are the agora, the marketplace of ideas, which allow people to exchange, polish, improve all of the things that they have been thinking. They are the community generating force, and that is what has allowed disassembled pieces. Cable news has been around since the early 1990s. Mailing lists have been around since the early days of the internet. Political organizations on the internet have been around since the late 1990s. Websites devoted to particular political ideas since the 1998-1999. These things have been disassembled. They've been fragmented. You couldn't put them together. You couldn't capture the video off of a cable news appearance of your favorite candidate and put it on your website and select out the best sound bites and send them to other people and say, this is where this candidate is. This is the line that's going to win this campaign for us. The blogs are the place where the connection happens. They're the Roman Forum or the Agora of Athens, to repeat the metaphor. That's what makes them important. They're the place where people come together and interact tightly, cohesively, continuously.
Sterling Newberry, you're hip, you're hot, you're happening. This is so interesting. We're going to continue this conversation. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Leiden.